You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and the other gentleman on the screen who doesn't look like me is Tom Lutt. And I am eager for this conversation, mostly because I think I'm going to learn something, but also because I will say, you know, I looked through so many of the bios that are online, you know, a Wikipedia page, it is. And the one thing that was missing, which was this most salient point of my experience in our last conversation, is Tom Lutz is somebody you want to speak to again, which is how I felt after our last conversation. It's like, I'd like to speak to him again. So
back at you.
That's happening.
Here we are.
Thank you. Thank you. The instance that brings us together is it soon to be published or is it out now?
It's I actually just got my copies yesterday.
It is a new publication, 1925, a literary encyclopedia, and we'll talk about other things. But let's, if you don't mind, let me just say, unless you want to say, Tom Lutz was a professor for many years at various places, but UC Riverside is where he landed for I forget how many years, but and retired about 10 years.
18, 20, 18 yeah. or yeah.
Time flies when you're
yes, even if you're not.
Yeah, you're not burning the candle at every end possible. The other thing that people might know the name associated with is Los Angeles Review of Books, and hopefully a little later on we'll talk about what possessed him to do such a thing to himself. Yeah, happily he did such a thing to himself because everybody else gets the benefit from it. But so Tom, thank you for being willing to, well, you're not waking up early. Thank you for being willing to sit down at the end of the day and from your palatial office and speak. Really appreciate it.
But
at any rate, in addition to being a professor and the founding, was it editor, publisher of the Los Angeles Review of Books, in his spare time, Tom has written numerous books, articles, et cetera, I will put them in the notes rather than read them here, and in a bunch of different genres. And 1925 is also an atypical genre.
Yes.
If it is a genre, it is an encyclopedia, but it's an encyclopedia that is not stuffy or at least from this side, and I don't pretend to have read the whole thing. It has definitely got a personality, and I'm assuming most of it is your personality throughout.
Yes.
Yeah. So a couple of things about that. So, why 1925, and why this format? Why an encyclopedia?
Yeah, they're related. They're related answers. It's 1925 because 1925 is the most amazing year in the history of American literature. It is an amazing year in American culture, amazing world year in the world culture, but in American literature in particular, it's everybody knows The Great Gatsby. That's 1925. It's Hemingway's first book. It's Faulkner's first short stories. It's T.S. Eliot's first collected poems. It's Ezra Pound's first cantos. It's Gertrude Stein's The Making of Americans. It's John Dos Passos' Manhattan Transfer. It's Willa Cather's The Professor's House. And it just kind of William Carlos Williams in The American Grain.
Oh, wow.
Just kind of goes on and on. With that, an amazing list of fundamental contributions to American literature. So that was the inciting cause. It was also because I had decided 40 years ago to write a book on the 1920s. My first book was on the year 1903, and I had decided then I was going to write a book on the 20s. Then I was going to write a book on the 50s. I was going to write a book on the 80s, and then I was going to catch up to myself and write about contemporary literature. And so I started the 1920s book in 1990, and started writing a book about the 20s. So this is a long procrastinated project, that in part because I wasn't sure what it was going to be.
Have you taken some of the other plans off the to-do list?
Oh yeah, yes, absolutely. I'm not going to write any of those other books that I had planned then. None of them, zero. I every once in a while I run into a bio that I wrote for myself in which I project what I'm going to be doing next.
Yeah,
and it's remarkable how few of those things I ever did.
Yeah, well, I think that's having nothing to do with this conversation, but maybe everything. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good sign, that the idea that lives travel in any sort of straight lines. Mm-hmm. I think unless somebody is really unlucky, lives don't do that. And, yes. Things unfold in these ways that are, if you're lucky, surprising and take turns that who could have anticipated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel very lucky to be able to have done all of the things that I've done. I mean, I feel like, and it's partly because of what happened to my discipline, literary studies, over the course of my career, where all of a sudden we could write about anything. We no longer were writing about Milton and Wordsworth, everybody in the industry.
And do you attribute any of that to to what made the 20s or the 1925, that birth of quote modernity, whatever that meant?
Yes. Although, the kind of real origins of what happened to my discipline are more or less in the 60s and 70s rather than in the 20s, so halfway between then and now.
So you just named a bunch of different authors, mm-hmm. all of which everyone has heard of, I'm assuming.
Right.
Well, many people have heard of.
Many, right.
Do you have is there a through line that can explain why at that point, this upswell of holy mackerel, look what's going on?
Yeah, there are three or four parts of the puzzle. One, it has to do with the 20s were a very fast series of boom and bust cycles in the economy. Obviously, in 1929 is the huge bust it ushers in the Great Depression. But long before that big stock market crash, it was very up and down the decade. So in 1924 happened to be one of those years when everything got very tight financially and publishers were slowing down their publication. They didn't have the cash to do their whole slate, and people weren't buying as many books. So there was a kind of backlog of things. Theodore Dreiser's American Tragedy, for instance, was supposed to come out in 1924. He, of course, required enormously tough editing before any of his books were ready. So it made sense to slow him down a little bit anyway, but they were happy to do it because they were running out of money. So in 25, everything was looking up again, big boom. They published everything from 1924, everything from 1925. And just to get a jump on things in case things went south again, they published some stuff early from 1926. So there's a little bit of a compression that way.
Yeah.
But it was also a longer cycle in the history of publishing. We're in a moment very similar now, which is that the big houses were conglomerating. So Doubleday bought Page and World, and a lot of the big publishers bought up other publishers, became behemoths, did a lot more bottom line thinking. The kind of creative editors didn't have as much say in their own slate as they had before. So there was a real kind of push towards blockbuster bestseller in the main industry. And the result was the same as the result in recent years in America, which is that lots of tiny little publishers popped up and picked up all of that creative energy that was getting ignored by the major houses. So Knopf was founded in the 20s, and Bonnie and Livright and Reinhardt. Lots of new publishers, lots of tiny little publishers in Paris. Some rich kids started presses that published Gertrude Stein and Hemingway and people like that. So it was that makes for some of the ferment.
Do you think, you think it is always the case that there are extraordinary, well, pick a field, we happen to be in literature, but that there's always extraordinary writers and writing going on. And, If we could only find them all, or are there periods that, you know, for whatever reason, some we could speculate and some we'll never know, it produces extraordinary work much more so. Like, you know, I mean, are people always making great films? We just don't see most of them. Are people always writing great things? Are people always making wonderful art, you know, extraordinary art, earth-shattering art, whatever that means? Or was there something about, other than they all got published, were there something about the time?
First and foremost, yes, people are always making great art, and we see so little of it.
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah. Think about, you know, and when I started LA Review of Books, it was in part a real sense that so many things flew under the radar, and books could get published and kind of thrown into the ocean of books and not even make a ripple on the surface.
Right. Exactly.
And it was like, well, how do we get an audience for some of this great stuff? So that's the main answer. Yes. So there's always great art, and just imagine the poetry getting written everywhere around the world every day. Yes. That not only never finds a publisher, but never moves out of a notebook. You know, never moves
out of a notebook. Right.
Right.
Great music that is played in somebody's basement.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, and
of course.
Please.
Of course, there's great art that is not particularly recognized by its own time. That then, right? If we're lucky, it did get published, and somebody finds it later.
Right. Right. That's what I was thinking. Is that, you know, I remember as a kid, you know, everybody when they're learning about visual art, right? You know, you bump into Van Gogh, and the sexy story is his ear. Right. And there's even a self-portrait of that moment, of that time.
Right.
And then a sort of throwaway that I don't even know registered until years later is that, but he never sold a painting except, you know, his brother secretly bought his painting so that it was basically to keep him in paint and brushes,
right,
so we could keep doing it.
And ear bandages.
And ear bandages. Right. How much of that, right? You know, how much of that never makes it out of, and you turned towards Los Angeles Review of Books, but also, what was the question or what was the puzzle problem to which Los Angeles Review of Books was your answer?
Oh, that's a great question, but and there are a couple different versions of that answer as well, a couple different, you know, vectors at work. One was I had just kind of arrived academically. I was at the top of my ladder. Yeah. There was no other brass ring for me to reach for in the academic world. I had gotten the offer at a prestigious place and stayed at Riverside. And so I felt incredibly lucky. I was set. And I thought, you know, it's time to give back. Right at that moment, a guy in San Francisco who was publishing a small journal called Ziziva, which is a literary magazine. It was very, very important in the 80s and 90s in particular to literary culture on the West Coast, but nationally as well. And he was retiring. He had just published a piece of mine, a kind of wacky experimental piece that I had done that I liked a lot about job interviews. And he asked if I would be interested in taking over the journal. And it had not occurred to me as something that I wanted to do, but I thought it would be great for my university if we took on this journal. It would be great because I was in a creative writing department. It would be great for our students. They could work on it a little bit. I taught at Iowa for 18 years as well. And the Iowa Review was something that one professor ran a class in the Iowa Review. So every year the class would basically read all of the submissions, learn how to be publishers basically in the course of the semester, from the beginning of the process to the end. And so I thought, well, this would be a great thing. And I talked to my faculty, my fellow faculty members, and said, look, there are 12 of us. If we each edited one issue, it's a quarterly, one issue every 3 years, we would do it. It would be great for all of us. And I thought that was a great idea. I thought because it wouldn't be too much work. We could build a really interesting magazine. There are so many great, interesting people working there. You know, Juan Felipe Herrera was there, and Mike Davis, and the faculty. It was just like such a broad, wide range of interesting people. Chris Abani, who's a Nigerian American novelist, who was there at the time, said, "I don't know why you would buy a used journal when you can get a new one for free. And you just launch it on the internet, and it doesn't cost anything. So, do you really want Ziziva, the magazine you always wanted to produce?" And I thought, well, that's interesting. If it was really up to me, what does the world need now? What does the literary world need right now? And it happened to be right when all of the Sunday supplement book reviews were dying. So the LA Times used to have a Sunday insert book section, 20 pages, long, more sometimes, covered 30 books a week, 40 books a week. So, you know, a major book review that got closed down. Then they put the book review in as a 4-page piece in the regular calendar section. Right. That's what later went down to 2 pages. And then the same thing happened. I actually remember feeling
like my paper was, hey, I didn't give me my paper. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Where's the book review?
What happened?
Seattle paper, the Denver paper, the Des Moines Register, Sunday supplement book review, the Boston Herald shut down its book review, a Washington Post shut down its, and all across the Chicago Tribune. And a number of these were places that I used to write for. I used to do book reviews for a number of them. And so it was the New York Times book review was the last Sunday supplement left standing. And of course there was a New York Review of Books, but I thought we should do something to replace the book review. And if we're going to do it online, it could even be bigger. We wouldn't be hemmed in by paper, you know, sure. cost of paper and
right. delivery, so, all that.
All of that. Yep. So I decided, I said to my faculty members, I said, do you think we should start the Los Angeles Review of Books instead of Zizibity? What do you think about doing that? I think that would also be good for the students and good for the department. And they all said that's a great idea. Yes, we should definitely do that. What they meant was, yes, you should definitely do that.
Yeah.
Has it turned out?
Took a step backwards, and suddenly, hey, how'd that happen?
And then, like a lot of things, it was something that I just started talking to people about. I talked to a lot of authors, and I don't know why I got this idea, but I thought if I could get some very fancy authors to say that they were contributing editors to the magazine, that would give it some prestige. You know, immediate prestige. It would give it, show that there were people behind it that believed in it. So I asked everybody, almost everybody, only two authors that I asked said no. Everybody else said sure. I did promise them that they didn't have to contribute to be a contributing editor. They just were basically lending their name to it. And so everybody said yes. And I launched with a 250 member strong board of contributing editors, Jeff.
and even two fewer hours of sleep those nights, and that's right.
Oh yeah. But by that time, I was kind of pot committed, as we say in the poker, right? I just there was no way out. I had just talked about it.
Exactly.
I had to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious about, and I want to circle back to 1925, the book. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about the reception. I mean, was it, you know, were people patting you on the back, or was there a, you know, East Coast eye rolling Scott? What?
You know, yes.
Come on.
Both. Yeah. Both. A lot of patting on the back and a lot of talking behind the back at the same time. Yeah. and you know,
there is that, and it's still there, obviously, right? You know, there is that, if it's coming from the West Coast, it must be superficial.
Exactly.
That still somehow exists.
Which and I admit that when I moved to Los Angeles, I had that image of LA as a cultureless culture in my head. And it wasn't until I was there and started meeting.
It's that Woody Allen line from Annie Hall. Why would I want to move to a place where the only cultural advantage is being able to make a right turn on a red light?
Yeah, and I believe he also said that was he the origin of the what's the difference between California and yogurt? That yogurt has an active culture. That's the but but of course we know, because we've spent a lot of time there, we know that this is an incredibly vibrant intellectual culture.
Well, I think that's the you know, and that's the question before, because my story is, and I don't know if it's true, but my story is that there's always extraordinary talent expressing itself all over the place.
Yeah, no, I do think that. And I do, you know, I think it in part, the West Coast has always been a place that's got less investment in old hierarchies, right? Because it necessarily became, you know, people came here and they were starting fresh, and no matter what they came from, there aren't like 10 generation families,
exactly.
You know, industrial families in Los Angeles. Right. So it was clearly part of the impetus for LA Review Books. It was like, let's do this, but let's do it in a way that's a bit less snooty and a bit less hide bound and a bit less kind of beholden to the publishing industry, and the publishing industry, you know, again, being conglomerating and getting corporate, right?
Right. It didn't lose its self-importance as the keeper of culture, but it wasn't making the decisions based on the same things that, right?
Yes. And of course, there remained. The bottom line was determining a lot of things. A lot of the same creative people were in it in publishing in 2010 when we launched, 2009 when we launched other books that were there 10 years and 20 years and 30 years earlier. So we still had a lot of great people doing great work. But we wanted to kind of really pay attention to the new smaller publishers. We wanted to pay attention to genre fiction. The New York Times used to have a page about mysteries and that kind of thing, but they pay attention to science fiction and mystery and
romance.
We ended up doing less of that than I'd hoped, partly because the people that were drawn to being part of the community that built Los Angeles Review of Books were people that were committed to literary culture, serious literary culture. And so a lot of them didn't have any more interest in science fiction than the New York Times. It was very much a kind of Amish barn raising adventure. People were working for free. We were all working for free. I started raising some money, and we started to kind of put together a board of directors and build a nonprofit.
Is it a nonprofit?
Yeah. And it still is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course now with the NEH and the NEA getting shut down, we were getting grants from the federal government that we will undoubtedly never get again.
Right.
At least in these 4 years. So it's a nonprofit that's struggling in a brand new way,
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's circle back for a bit to the 1925 and did you bump into any surprises? You know, you had been familiar with the 20s and 25 in particular for a while, having planned to write about it 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Did you surprise yourself or what?
Absolutely. Up until the last minute. I mean, literally. if it wasn't 2025 right now, I would still be adding entries and still be being surprised by new stuff.
Really?
Just remarkable that, you know, people who literary scholars know some of them. So somebody like Lewis Bromfield, who was considered at the time one of the great new young men who were writing novels, his Possession was one of the best-selling books of 1925. He was an interesting guy whose protagonists tended to be women, and who moved to Paris with a lot of the rest of the young people, like when Hemingway and Fitzgerald and everybody were going to Paris, he went as well. But he found it a little too distracting to be in Paris. So he moved up out into the suburbs, became a neighbor of Edith Wharton's, who lived up there. And Edith Wharton famously was a gardener. He started getting interested in gardening and ended up becoming one of the kind of original, the OG organic gardening guys. He became interested in the experiments people were doing in India, and then what became known as French intensive gardening, raised beds and heavy composting and that kind of thing. So he moved back to Ohio where he grew up, bought a farm, called it Malabar Farm, after where one of the experimental stations in India was set. And it was a real cultural phenomenon in the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. He was writing books about organic gardening. He just as one example of how important he still was, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall got married at Malabar Farms.
Well,
they got married at his place because he was this guy kind of way before the Back to the Land movement that you and I know about from the 60s and 70s. He had basically started a Back to the Land movement, Back to the Land organic gardening movement. Some of it, very basic stuff like contour plowing that is now crop rotation, things that are completely accepted even by mainstream farming. But
that's interesting.
So
there were dozens of these. Yeah, exactly. It's Bob, who knows? Yeah. And I don't even know how to ask this question. How did you, was it simply your creativity, whatever that meant, but that you decide, that led you to decide one entry is more a story, another is more academic, how'd that play itself out?
Well, I've done a number of travel books. And one of the things that I realized as I was doing the travel books is that you don't always, when you're first looking at anything or first experiencing anything, you don't always know where the story is. So that a lot of people, when they're traveling, they're keeping notebooks and they're keeping, writing as they go, almost diary based travel writing. And I would take notes mostly about the way people were talking, because that was the one thing that I found I didn't remember well, is exact syntactical difference as somebody would speak in a very specific way. So I would jot down the way somebody was speaking, but I would realize much later, oh, the story is the meeting that guy. That's the story about Myanmar, or that's the story about Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
And so later, so I'd be reading a book, I'd be reading a biography of one of these people and didn't always immediately become clear what the story was. But once the story became clear, then it was fun to tell it.
Actually, that's
crafted into a story.
And
80% of it, 90%.
Well, as you were just speaking, the world silos everything, right? So there's a discipline called history, and there's a discipline called English or literature, or here in this case, creative writing. A creative writer, or a literary scholar or a literary critic, is writing nonfiction about a period of time or a place or a is that you bringing your take on what writing or creative writing or literature means, and forcing it into print because you had reached a certain stature in your life where you could pull that off, or is that a widely accepted? There's no if there are those lines between things, they are everybody's allowed to make them blurry.
Yeah, and when I was in graduate school in the 1980s, interdisciplinarity was the buzzword of the moment.
Yes. So
in a sense, I'm just a product of my historical moment, as well. And so, and I may have run a little bit farther with it than
others. Yeah.
Some of the people that were teaching me thought it was wise, but it was very much, very much of the moment. And, yeah. and we thought that was the smart thing to do. It was partly an over siloing, an understanding of what happens when you're writing about a psychological novel and you know nothing about psychology. Right. You know, it makes sense to bring these different disciplinary lenses to bear.
I remember raising my hand in a psychology class and saying, how can there be a psychology without a sociology? And vice versa, right? You know, it's like, and I remember the professor looked at me, he's displeased.
Okay. Yeah.
Which made me sure that I had asked the right question. So, yeah.
I actually spent a little time writing about interdisciplinarity early in my career. And one of the things I bumped into was the fact that there's a subdiscipline in psychology called social psychology.
Yeah.
And there's a subdiscipline in sociology called social psychology. And they have different journals. They have different.
I know. It's the wackiest thing in the world. Yeah. Right. So, and it's funny because I, in education, it became, you know, it became like always a mantra, right? I mean, it's like, you know, interdisciplinary, and it was the, you know, people try to put science and math together, and people try to put history and English together, and there I was finding myself writing this thing. I don't know what became of it. That was actually arguing against teaching that way, not because I thought it was sensible, but because I remember the thrill of discovering that these so-called separate sections came together, and that if we taught it together, they would take that thrill away for the student who was taking them seriously. And it's like, that's not a good idea. There was something thrilling about that moment.
There's something thrilling about it. And there's something about real expertise, you know, serious, serious expertise, which requires, for most of us, I mean, there are a few polymathic geniuses out there. But for most of us, it requires siloing ourselves a little bit. It requires really knowing how many angels do dance on the head of that.
Right, exactly.
It requires that. So, and it occurred to me as I was writing some of this stuff back ages ago, that really what I was doing required the disciplinary people to do their work so I could take it and mix it in with these other things. So I wrote a book about the history of tears, the history of crying. And that book, I taught myself how to read the physiological journals and the chemical journals and all these things. So I could really understand this stuff, but I didn't do any experiments. I didn't put together a set of research protocols. Right. I needed the people who were doing that to do their work so that I could take what they found.
That sounds fascinating. What's the name of that book?
It's called Crying.
The Natural and Cultural History of Tears. Yeah. Oh my God! I didn't notice that. Now I'm going to go find it.
That was a fun one.
I'm looking at the clock, and. And try to, but
we haven't. I realize that I didn't answer your first question.
I know, but that's all right. It took us some.
Yeah, but it was about why an encyclopedia.
Yeah,
and this is related to what we were just talking about forms of knowledge and how we put the world together, how we put various kinds of understanding together, And I've always been fascinated by the way in which, back in the 80s when I was in graduate school, one of the things everybody was talking about was the Annales school and in French historiography, you know, this kind of the history of everyday life, how you get away from the great man theory of history and somehow actually talk about the history of everyone rather than just what Churchill said to FDR
exactly.
Yalta, you know, right. That kind of thing. So, and at one point, as I'm kind of trying to kind of have a kind of theoretical framework for myself about history, I came up with this idea that if somehow a really great history would be a collection of anecdotes that had as many voices as possible in it. And that to reduce all of those anecdotes to a single through line, explanatory through line, you know, it's all about, you know, to take one of my favorite historians, Richard Hofstadter, the paranoid style in American politics, or anti-intellectualism in America. So we've got all of this data. It all is about anti-intellectualism in America. Well, a lot of it is, but that doesn't really explain everything. Right. So it was this idea that you get closer to the truth if you don't hew too closely to a single story.
Right.
The multiplicity of stories is what happened. So the encyclopedia is a perfect way to have all of these different stories all lined up. And they do have different weights. As you said, some of them are longer, some of them are shorter. Some of them get a lot of attention. Some of them are just a paragraph. So I'm making some judgments about what's important and what's not, which voice is worth listening to rather than that, which other voice. But there, in other ways, they're all existing on the same plane.
And in some ways, I mean, I don't know if this is your experience, but it's sort of having landed on that form offers a lot of freedom.
Absolutely.
You don't have to, you're not a slave to something that now people are expecting. It's an encyclopedia. It's like Wikipedia, right? You know, you look up Tom Lutz and there's a page and a half, and you look up Barbie and there's like 40 pages.
I think that's a fair judgment on our relative importance. I do.
I get it. Well, I'm going to ask you because I'm just going to, we have to end. Once again, Tom Lutz is one of those people you want to speak to again. There's my thing. Is there something that sort of comes to mind about that time, the 20s, 25, that sheds light, offers direction, points in a direction that would be worthwhile, beneficial today? I'm always asking people that whose answers I think could be helpful. How's that? I'm always asking people you got any clues about where we are and what we need that you can titrate out of 1925?
Yes. There are so many ways in which what was happening in that period. I have one entry on what a century means. And it's very easy to say, well, obviously, if you just think about electronic technology, everything is different, right? Everything is completely different. But if you think about the fight about immigration in America, the first quota laws were, it was 1924. This is the height of anti-immigrant rhetoric. Obviously, the Ku Klux Klan was resurgent, right? After a period of dormancy. So as we watch this new wave of racism come over the U.S., very similar thing was happening. And, you know, people read this in The Great Gatsby when Tom Buchanan is talking about eugenics. He says, have you read this? The Rise of the Colored Empires by this man Stoddard. And Nick Carraway comments, you know, it was surprising that he had been taken in by an idea. He didn't think Tom could do that, you know, but it was just one small part of it. Ho Chi Minh founds the Communist Party in Vietnam in 1925. Mussolini becomes, takes on Il Duce in 1925. Adolf Hitler publishes Mein Kampf in 1925. So there's that kind of rise of nationalist fascism, which we're seeing again now. So in all sorts of ways, the century is a period in which things can change radically and return exactly to the same place. That's not exactly the same place, but a version of the same place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are a lot of lessons for, you know, ways in which cultures can go horribly wrong, and ways in which the you know, I was listening to John Wiener's podcast, The Nation podcast, Start Making Sense, and he had he was talking to one of his guests about who said this, the resistance, you know, this idea that we have to have a resistance to what the worst things that are happening in our country at the moment. How do we have the kind of resistance that
right.
we need?
How do we mount an effective resistance? Right.
And one way to look at it is it's the kind of the rise of Trump and Orban and Netanyahu, and you know, you just pick your right wing leader. They are the resistance. Modernity is forging ahead. The changes that have been wrought over this 100 years they're permanent. We're seeing a retrenchment. We're seeing, and it could be a retrenchment that could bring in a whole new centuries long dark ages. We don't know exactly, right. but much more likely is that this is a last gasp resistance to all of the amazing opening up of the human experience that the 20th is a great example of, and we've had many examples since. And
yeah,
I believe we'll have many examples
that is
moving forward.
That is a wonderfully positive note to end on. And as I said now twice and about to say the third time, I have that same feeling. Tom Lutz is somebody you want to speak to again. So I hope that happens.
And I do as well. Let's do it again.
Whether it is online or in person or both down the road. And thank you. Thank you so much.
Maybe you want to write your book at our writer's residency here in France.
There you go. Yeah, that's almost enough to tempt me to become a writer.
Almost.
Exactly.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.